Just a month ago, a series of giant ocean waves touched off by an earthquake devastated countries all around the Indian Ocean. It is now estimated that more than 220,000 people died, and the level of death and destruction has made this tsunami one of the most destructive natural events in history. There has been a great outpouring of concern and aid from around the world for the victims of the tsunami, and we'll talk this morning a little bit about just some of the challenges involved in trying to help the people who have experienced such an overwhelming natural disaster, and also how it is that aid organizations go about trying to hold the public attention, because we know that it won't be very long before something else comes along to knock that off of the headlines and off of the front pages of the newspapers of this country and off of television coverage. There will be something else. And it certainly has happened in the past that there have been natural disasters that have gotten a lot of attention, have gotten promises of aid, and then people tended to forget. They went on to something else. It's also been reported that so many aid organizations have been interested in helping in this region that they're actually starting to get in each other's way, and that that can be a problem. We'll try to explore these and perhaps other questions this morning in this part of Focus 580 with two guests. Stephanie Bunker is the Public Information Officer and Spokesperson for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs and has had that post since the fall of 2002. Before that, she worked for 3 years in the Office of the UN Coordinator for Afghanistan, located in Pakistan, where she served as a spokesperson. That was during and after the time of the Taliban in Afghanistan, including the time after September 11th. Before that, she worked as reports officer for the UN World Food Program for Afghanistan. She has lived in Pakistan at two different times for a total of 12 years. Also joining us is Joan Neal. She is the Vice President for U.S. Operations for Catholic Relief Services. And included in her responsibilities are relationships, initiatives, and programs that serve American Catholics, including things like institutional and university relations, regional outreach and support, policy and advocacy. It also manages national programs like the Global Fellows Program and the Fair Trade Coffee Project. Before starting to work with Catholic Relief Services, she was president of a management consulting firm, J.F. Neal & Associates, that specialized in strategic planning and leadership development for nonprofits. And they are both joining us by telephone, and we are pleased to have them with us on the program today. Now, as we talk, of course, as always with the show, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, but anybody who is interested in calling in can do that. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. And as a matter of fact, if you were listening on the internet, you could use that number as long as you're in the United States, and that number is 800-222-9455. Locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Stephanie Bunker, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it. And also Joan Neal.
Good morning.
Thank you again, also for being with us on the show.
Thank you for having me.
To start out here, maybe what I would like to do first is to give each of you the chance to talk just a little bit more about what it is that you do and your organizations, and particularly maybe Stephanie Bunker could talk a little bit about what the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs does.
Well, our office works only in what we call complex emergencies, which are countries in crisis, countries that you see in the headlines like Sudan, Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of Congo. And then the other area in which we work is in the area of natural disasters. So that's why we're working on this disaster. And our task, which is unenviable in a way, is to try to coordinate humanitarian assistance to all of these kinds of disasters.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly, and from many of the stories that I have been reading, that certainly does seem to be a challenge, because there were non-governmental organizations and organizations who are interested in working in situations like this who either were already in the region or recognized the need and went there. And it is my understanding, as I said, that it's actually starting to become a problem that there are so many people who are there trying to do this work that literally they seem to be getting in each other's way. Is that right?
Well, I think what you always see when there's a big crisis is that you have organizations, as you rightly pointed out, that were already on the ground, whether national or international. And then because of great outpouring of goodwill, you see a lot of other people start to show up. This can be more problematic on the ground sometimes because these organizations just don't know their way around yet, as well as those who are there. And also, they're not necessarily tied into the coordination network that would exist, because all of these countries that we're talking about here already have UN country teams, and all country teams have their mechanisms for interacting with non-governmental organizations, governments, and so forth. So, you know, this is going to happen. We can only hope that they don't get underfoot with each other too much.
Mm-hmm. Well, is the problem that you have people who perhaps mean well but don't have the expertise, the resources, aren't familiar with the local situation to do it, or that it is more a case that you have people, you have a duplication of efforts so that in one particular area you have a lot of people who are trying to work, and then you have an area that might be close by that would also need help, but there's nobody over there. And for you, it's a matter of saying, okay, maybe some people should be here and some people should be over here and then some people should be over there.
That is precisely, you know, the idea behind coordination. Now, what we're doing in Indonesia right now in Aceh, for example, is now that we have people in Banda Aceh, we're widening the net and we're moving out into other areas. And when we do this, you have, normally the way the UN operates with NGOs is that you'll have the country divided up into sectors. And some agency, whether it's a UN or an NGO, will be in charge of each sector, for example, water or sanitation or health, nutrition, food aid, you know, all of these internally displaced people. And it's the task of that agency to try to work with those people who are there on the ground and to analyze the situation insofar as they can, as rapidly as they can, and say, okay, you know, too many people are here, why don't you guys go there? You know, but do it in a way that uses consensus, because you can't really force people to, you know, to do what needs to be done. But I think you can persuade them, because they are there to do good.
Let me turn here to Joan Neal and ask you to talk a little bit about what specifically Catholic Relief Services is trying to do there.
Certainly. Well, first of all, Catholic Relief Services is the official humanitarian relief and development organization of the Catholic community of the United States. So we represent the church structure in the United States and Catholics all over this country in the work that we do. We are working currently in about 96 countries around the world with about 4,000 staff worldwide on the ground. And we not only work in emergencies such as this, but we're also working in long-term development of communities, because we recognize that the first response, while a necessary response in emergencies, is not sufficient, but that, you know, there needs to be efforts to rebuild communities and to help them to move beyond the effects of the immediate situation. In terms of the way that we work in country, as Stephanie has said, you know, we work with partners all over the world. Typically our first partner and our partner of choice in any country is the local church organization. So the Catholic Church around the world has a level of structure that is, once in place, allows us then to begin to deliver humanitarian aid quickly and efficiently. And that's actually what allowed us to be one of the first responders within hours after the tsunami hit. So we work not only with the church structure, but we also work with other international NGOs, other local NGOs, and, of course, local governments as well.
Mm. And just I want to make sure that, people understand that you're, and certainly it would be my understanding that you're, even if you would be working with churches in a particular area, it would not, you would not limit your assistance either to people who are Catholics or people who are Christians.
That's absolutely correct. We serve people on the basis of need, not on the basis of their beliefs or their political situations or their race or whatever. We are, in fact, many of our staff in country are locals from the various communities where we work.
I understand that recently you were in, quite recently, you were in India.
Yes.
Had you had the opportunity to visit some areas that were affected by the tsunami?
I did. I visited Chennai and Pondicherry and some areas in between. All of those areas on the southeast coastline of India were pretty hard hit by the tsunami.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what it is that you saw?
Well, as you know, India was not the hardest hit of all the countries that were hit. Indonesia certainly experienced much more devastation. But what I saw was, for me, pretty unbelievable. I saw, you know, thatched huts and concrete buildings just leveled and just, you know, turned into debris. And, of course, I met with and saw many, many people who have experienced deep trauma and psychological devastation, having lost family members and friends and neighbors and, of course, all of their worldly possessions. It is the kind of devastation, I think, that I've heard many veterans in the relief and development field say that they've never seen before.
Hmm. Let me just turn back for a moment here to Stephanie Bunker. And as I continue to read the stories that come out of the region, talking about the number of people that were killed, the amount of destruction, the numbers just keep going up. The last that I saw said that in Indonesia alone, they're talking about more than 160,000 people having been killed. And past that, more than 220,000. And then when you read about things like the number of people who were just generally affected, if you include people who maybe lost family, who lost their homes, who lost their way of making a living in Indonesia alone, that number starts to get up to, say, a million people. What sort of numbers, if you talk about the overall impact of this event, could we be talking about?
Well, the numbers are huge. In terms of the death toll, though, I have to say that that's a bit contentious at this point because there's just not enough known. In fact, parts of the Indonesian government are simply counting the death toll as the number of people that they have buried. And that's approaching 100,000. And then there's many, 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 many more missing. But in addition to those who lost their lives, you're right, there are those who have been affected. And that's somewhere upward of 5 million. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as Joan was saying, you know, what we have to look at here, there's many ways of being affected by a disaster like this. It may be direct loss of property or homes or, you know, lives. It may be injuries. It may be trauma. Right, a lot of people in these areas, if they have not lost their home, well, then someone they know has lost their home. And inevitably, in situations like this, particularly in Indonesia, the survivors wind up staying with other survivors, putting, you know, more pressure on other families economically and in all ways. So it has a lot of ripple effects.
I have a caller we want to get right to, and perhaps also for people who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I should introduce again the guests. Stephanie Bunker works as Public Information Officer for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs and is based in New York City. And also our second guest is Joan Neal. She is Vice President of U.S. Operations for Catholic Relief Services, and this is the official relief organization for American Catholics. And we're talking about some of the challenges faced by relief organizations as they try to deal with a natural disaster of the scale of the tsunami that hit in Southeast Asia a month ago. Questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana listeners, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone to talk with in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I wanted to expand and ask a question. Specifically, I was glad to hear the representative of the Catholic Relief Organization say that they don't predicate relief on the basis of religious identification. However, I've been concerned because I've read quite a number of reports of missionary groups who are predicating relief or requiring that in order to have relief or including with the relief missionary activity, evangelizing specifically Christian groups. There was reports coming out of Sri Lanka linked to a group in Waco, Texas. I don't remember the name of the church. Other groups from other parts of the South who said quite openly that, yes, we are doing this as part of our attempt to bring people to Christ. And going on about this, whether in Indonesia, in Thailand, and in part the, the general disorganization of the times and the needs of the people seems to being taken advantage of. So I wondered if both of your guests could talk about, one, the extent that this is happening, two, what they're doing about it, or whether they're doing anything about it, and maybe talk a little more about sensitivity and respect for different religious traditions, whether Muslim, Buddhist, Hindu.
Well, it's certainly a fine question. Maybe Ms. Neal, would you like to take a shot at that first, and then we could ask Stephanie Bunker to do the same.
Sure. Certainly, let me just say again that as far as Catholic Relief Services is concerned, we deliver our aid and respond to people's needs on the basis of need, and we do not proselytize. That is not a part of the way that we operate. I can only say that I know of what the caller is speaking of by what I read in the newspapers as well. We are in-country concerned with dealing with people's real needs, you know, for water and sanitation and shelter and helping to rebuild livelihoods. And so we don't spend a whole lot of time, don't have a lot of time, but don't spend a whole lot of time monitoring what other groups are doing, especially in that regard. I will say that we very much try to respect, it's a priority for us to respect the cultural norms within the communities that we work. We've been at this for over 60 years, and as I said earlier, have, you know, nearly 4,000 staff on the ground. 300 of them are in the affected areas in India, Sri Lanka, and Indonesia. And we do have a long history in these areas, and so we are aware of some of the cultural issues, and we try to work very hard to respect them and to work within them. And that gives us the opportunity then, we believe, to be able to really be a part of the community and to help to meet the immediate needs and to be there for the longer haul.
You want, Ms. Bunker, you want to add anything to that?
Yes, I would like to add something to that. There are rules governing humanitarian aid, and that is that it should be neutral, impartial, and independent. Now, just like Catholic Relief Services, the United Nations works with a lot of partners on the ground, many, many, many NGOs, as I said before, both international and national. And the NGOs that we would work with and the bodies that we would work with would be the ones who observe those principles of humanitarianism and not those who would be doing anything to violate those principles. The country teams on the ground do know their regular partners, and to some extent, they have some knowledge of the new partners who have come in, and they would try to avoid working with partners who would be impinging upon the mores of the population.
Let me just, did the caller want to follow up? Have you responded to your question?
I appreciate their responses. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, other people who are listening, Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, let me ask you about a specific question and pose what would be an extremely difficult case, and I don't know how you might talk about it, but among the stories that I had read was stories about what had been happening apparently some places in India where there was conflict among people of different castes, and that the people of the Dalit caste, the people that are generally referred to as the untouchables by other caste people, were being denied aid by their neighbors, essentially, people of other castes who were trying to avoid contact with them. Now, I appreciate that you try, as Joan Neal said, that what you do is try to respect cultural norms. But here, this is something that's certainly contrary to the general spirit of trying to help people. What do you do in a situation like that? Or is there something that an outside aid organization can do when you're coming up against a cultural norm like that?
Might I speak to that?
Yes, please.
Well, I think particularly for us, our experience in India has been that because we work with the local church organization and the international church, the Caritas Internationalis network of 162 local Catholic charities, we have a history with and an experience with working across all the castes within the Indian society. So we were in that situation able to provide assistance to the Dalits and to the untouchable castes. And so, in many ways, because of our partner network and our relationships already on the ground, that situation has not been a hindrance for us to provide emergency assistance.
Hmm. Well, yes, and for our part, I mean, in yes. India in particular, because India is quite well equipped in terms of coping with natural disaster, the United Nations has really taken on really a support role to the government's own initiatives. And in this regard, I mean, what was going on there is also a violation of, Indian laws. I mean, this should not be happening in India as well. And so what the response of the United Nations would be in such a case would be, of course, to take it up with the authorities, with the local authorities, et cetera, and to work through that way.
All right. Let's go on to talk with some other people. We have someone here in Urbana where we are, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I don't know if either of your guests could address two questions I have, but I'll give it a shot anyway. One is I heard on ABC News that the worldwide security restrictions kind of imposed by the United States on the flow of money, particularly between Muslim countries, or from Muslim countries at least, had an effect on the flow of aid in reference to this particular disaster for bunker, I guess it is. Would she be able to speak to that at all?
Okay, in this particular crisis, I'm not aware that there has been a problem with this. I do, however, know. That this has been a problem for various Islamic NGOs throughout the world, and it has impeded their operations. And that's the reason why we have started now meeting, a process of meeting with Islamic NGOs, especially with a very important Islamic NGO called Islamic Relief, to see how we can help them make sure that their operations are very transparent so that their funding is not hindered. Thankfully, in this case, because the outpouring of assistance has been so very massive, I don't know to what extent that would have impeded the efforts so far. Because, so far, as you're probably aware, our latest figures that we just have reported to us indicate something around $5.3 billion in pledges overall for this crisis, and something like $775 million against our appeal of $977 million for the next 6 months. So that's not even counting a lot of the, massive outpouring of private donations to places like Catholic Relief Services, the International Committee of the Red Cross, Red Crescent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which has been massive. I mean, some people are speaking of private contributions of around $1 billion. So it is a serious concern. I don't know that it has been a true impediment in this case.
Yeah, in this case, but it could easily, you know, have been a much larger contribution. I imagine you're kind of saying, if, or at least you would put that in the realm of plausibility. But anyway, my second question is about is to Ms. Neal, and I read a peculiar note in a article a few years back by entitled "The Origins of the Overclass," and in it they mention that the Roman Catholic Church has this body within it called the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, and members are known as the Knights of Malta, and that apparently they include a lot of CIA agents and things like that, and it's a very mysterious organization. And I was just curious if you could speak, if you know anything about it, about a little bit about that, and perhaps by tie it into maybe by telling us if they had anything to do, had any activity at all with the tsunami relief. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, that's a little beyond the scope of the discussion, but Ms. Neal, you can comment that on that any way you like.
Sure. I'm certainly aware of the existence of the Knights of Malta. I don't know very much detail about them. I can say that we are not in partnership with the Knights, and I don't know whether or not they have had any part in response to the tsunami.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone listening in Rantoul, not too far away from here, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering if either of your organizations were interested in skilled volunteers, or how would you get your services assessed to see if you could be of any service in India?
We are, in fact, looking for some skilled volunteers. I mentioned earlier the extent of the psychosocial trauma that people have experienced and that I saw firsthand in India. And so we are looking for people, particularly with skills in that area, counseling skills in that area. And if you go to our website at www.catholicrelief.org, there is a portal on our web page, our front page, that will lead you to the volunteer section. And that will give you details as to how to contact us and to have your credentials taken a look at and an interview and a process from there as to how to proceed with a volunteer opportunity.
Well, that's interesting. I have a friend in Chicago that was interested in volunteering, and she works for a major corporation,
mm-hmm.
and the company will give people that want to volunteer up to a year off from their jobs to volunteer, and so I wanted to pass that on to her.
Well, certainly. Please pass on our website at www.catholicrelief.org, and there'll be more than enough, I think, information there to move that along. And thank you for the interest in wanting to give of your talents and gifts.
Well, yeah, she had talked about this with me. We'd had, like, several discussions on the phone about wanting to do it, but just not knowing how or where to go.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah,
all
thank
right.
You.
Well, thank you for the call. We are a bit past the midpoint here in this hour of Focus 580, and our guests once again are Joan Neal. She is Vice President of U.S. Operations for Catholic Relief Services. It's the official relief organization of U.S. Catholics. And also Stephanie Bunker. She is the Public Information Officer for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in New York City. And we're talking about some of the challenges involved in responding to a natural disaster of the scale of the tsunami of a month ago. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. If you'd like to call, toll free 800-222-9455. Another question I'd like to have both of you reflect on a little bit. Just a bit ago, Stephanie Bunker, you were talking about the amount of money that already had been contributed to relief, and also an even greater amount has been promised. So we're really talking about maybe $10 billion from donor nations, aid development banks, individuals, charities, a significant, very significant amount of money. In the wake of this disaster, however, I know that I read stories about in previous natural disasters in recent memory, you know, within the last 5, 10 years, places where aid was promised and rebuilding efforts were begun. And ultimately what happened was that a lot of the promised aid was never given, and relief efforts, rebuilding efforts have kind of bogged down, and in fact there are places that still have not recovered years afterwards. So I guess the question that I'm coming to is, how is it that, what can be done to, first of all, to make sure that if people promise money that it comes, and that then you stay on a project and stay with that when then the next thing comes along?
Well, that's a very good question. We've gotten a lot of questions about that. That's why we're following up extensively with the donors right now to try to make sure that the way this works is that you have something called the pledge, the commitment, and the disbursement. A pledge is just, you know, somebody saying we're going to give you money. It's when they actually commit it and disburse it that it actually counts for something. So we've been following up with the donors on trying to turn those pledges into commitments, because once they're commitments, it's a legal obligation to go ahead and provide the money. We're meeting again with the donors this week on Friday to try to encourage donors to make more pledges and commitments specifically to recovery activities. So we will keep following up on our side insofar as we can, but we would also look to, for example, to NGOs, to civil society, to voters, and to the media to remember that this tragedy occurred the day after Christmas this year, and to put pressure from their sides as well to make sure that their governments, you know, finally, you know, pay what they said they were going to pay and not drop the ball.
Hmm. Yeah, I would agree with Stephanie. And just to say, in our case, in private revenue, we have raised a little over $51 million. All of that is basically cash in hand. It is not pledges. So we have the ability to program that revenue right away. And we, too, are an organization that, as I said earlier, meets not only emergency needs, but we're there for the long term, for the rehabilitation and the rebuilding of communities. And we know, for instance, in India, that it's likely to take over 5 years to return the communities that were affected to some sense of normalcy. And we are making plans and committed to being there for the long term. We've done that in other emergency situations, and it is the way that we work all around the world.
Well, let me ask you this question. It may be that people don't understand how long it can take to rebuild after something like this. So if, for example, you go to some place that where there was a significant natural disaster 2 years ago or 3 years ago or maybe even 5 years ago, and if you look at that place and you say, well, this many years after, the recovery is still incomplete, maybe the answer to that question or the response would be, well, yes, it's still incomplete, and you really shouldn't expect that it would be. That maybe that people don't really understand how long it can take.
Yeah, I agree with Joan. Yeah. This is going to take years because of the extent of the devastation. And in a way, rehabilitation, rebuilding, recovery does have to be incremental. I mean, there are certain things that people have to have in hand before they have to have other things. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're planning now with governments about that very long process of recovery and trying to figure out, you know, how long it's going to take, what the priorities are, prioritize them, how much it's going to cost. But there are certain things that really have to be in place sooner than other things. And one of those things is the revenue to make sure that people can get their livelihoods back. Mm-hmm. In this case, a lot of farmers and a lot of fisher people were badly affected. They lost a lot of their assets. They lost their lands. They lost their crops. They lost their boats. They lost their nets. They lost a lot of stuff. Until we help them or someone helps them, whether it's an international financial institution, an aid group, or whatever, to get their livelihoods back, they are essentially independent. And these are people who were independent before. And that, I would argue, is one of the most important things we can do in this crisis.
We have some other calls to talk with. Let's do that. Next is someone in Champaign, and it's line one.
Hello, yes. I have a question for the host. I'm surprised to hear that the host say that caste discrimination is taking place in India at this point. The reports I have read, which are coming out of India, say that everybody is helping everybody else, irrespective of caste and religion, religious barriers. So could you please shed some light on the reports and the extent to which this is taking place, specifically upper caste denying help to Dalits?
Well,
and which areas and, you know, what the extent and where you read the reports and where can I access the reports?
I will try to do that here because I have a big stack of articles in front of me that I read through to prepare for the program. And certainly I have to say that this is not based on my personal experience, that it's based on what I have read in the international press. And maybe you might give me a moment here to do that. I don't know. Again, is this something that either of the guests have?
I would like them to basically shed some light on that. And is that really taking place?
Well, here,
what is the extent to which it is taking place?
Yes, I guess here my main...
I want some quantification of that. Basically.
My main source here, at least in just quickly looking through the material I have here, is a story that was published in the Independent newspaper in the UK. In fact, a couple of days ago, in the 22nd of January, it does indeed talk about this particular problem.
Which areas? Which area?
In Tamil Nadu.
Mm-hmm.
In
I mean, the reason why I'm specifically asking this question is that basically caste discrimination is illegal by Indian rules. So basically anybody who is doing that explicitly would be taken to court. They would be sued. And there is recourse, legal recourse for everybody. And it is not recognized in the Indian, Indian law. So basically, if it is the extent is very, very, it is very extensive, then you would see reports coming out, left and right, and there would be a lot of, legal problems for people who are actually doing that. That's all I wanted to say.
Yes.
I can say that I did have a conversation with one of the local parish priests in the Tamil Nadu area who told me that initially, in the first week after the tsunami, some of his parishioners who are Dalits did have difficulty getting assistance in terms of meeting their immediate needs for food and clean water and sanitation needs.
Are they Christians too, or are they Dalits?
I'm sorry?
Are the Christians or Dalits?
These were Dalits, but they were, they were his parishioners, so they were Catholic.
All right, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
However, his point was to thank Catholic Relief Services for the prompt response that we had in coming to their assistance.
How could they be Dalits when they are actually parishioners and they're going to church? I don't think the Catholic religion does recognize the caste system anyway.
Well, I can only speak for what this parish priest told me.
Okay, all right. So, it is incorrect to characterize them as Dalits then, right?
He made that characterization, and okay. I'm...
Okay, all right. Thanks for the, the
all
pointer.
Right.
I'll just follow it through.
Very good.
Thanks.
Let's go to another caller. This is Urbana, and it's line number two. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of points. We were last night at a dinner for tsunami fundraising, and it was great to see most of the community organizations come together from different denominations. It was held at the Wesley Foundation, and it was coordinated with the Muslim Students Association and the Red Cross chapter, and a number of people, including my family, and 200-some attended. And there was a speaker from the Islamic Relief, and he had mentioned the efforts that they were making in Indonesia and also coordinating with the Church of Jesus Christ. And it was good to know that the different religions joining hand in these efforts. Again, some of the student organizations coming together and raising these funds and joining hand, regardless of any religious, irrespective of their religious leanings. That was a good cause, and it raises U.S.'s image abroad as well. What however concerns me is one of the callers, which had a few callers ago had alluded to, is an email which was sent by Jerry Falwell and the Council of Islamic Relations that raised that issue, in which primarily he had mentioned that, and I quote, the email states that in this heavily Muslim part of the world, millions have never heard of Jesus Christ. So that kind of a statement coming does damage U.S.'s image and credibility. Well, generally speaking, I mean, of course, Muslims revere Jesus as prophet of God, and the Quran itself states specifically the Omeri, God give thee glad tidings of the word from him. His name will be Jesus Christ, the Son of Mary, held in honor in this world and the hereafter. And I'm reading this off the verses from the Quran here. And this email which Jerry Falwell wrote, he said that in addition, we'll be presenting the gospel to tens of thousands of persons through distribution of gospel tracts written in the native language of the area. Our ultimate purpose for this first mission is to set the stage for many other missions trips to this Asian region by the hundreds of Liberty students in the months to come. And this is appalling, I mean, and very disconcerting. These efforts actually hurt the U.S. image and the exploitation of the tragedy and the extremist propaganda that is coming about. So that and then this Christian group, the World group out of Virginia based, took about 50 to 300 children and were shipping them over to Christian orphanages, and a lot of hue and cry was raised, and they had to stop that, and the Indonesian government had to step in and stop them. So these two events actually specifically indicate that there's the ongoing effort on the part of some of the Christian groups to take advantage of this large disaster, whether in Indonesia or any other. Needless to say that regardless of any groups, whether they are Christian, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhist, to take advantage of this situation is inappropriate and immoral. I'd like your guest to comment on the Jerry Falwell's email, if they could, please. Thank you.
All right. Well,
as I commented earlier, I would also say that humanitarian assistance has to be neutral, impartial, independent, given on the basis of need and freely. Therefore, that precludes humanitarian assistance being given under those kinds of circumstances from our point of view.
Well, how exactly, though, does that, how exactly is that codified?
This is well known by all, you know, UN agencies and responsible NGOs as the fundamental principles of humanitarian assistance.
That's correct.
So that, though it is, it makes it sound as if that is something that perhaps is generally agreed upon,
yes,
in an informal sort of way. That is, we will not do this, but that there's nothing, there's no way, in fact, to hold any or group to that.
Well, I think part of the incentive for holding groups to compliance with those rules is the availability or lack thereof of government resources to provide humanitarian relief and development. Organizations that are known to proselytize would be ineligible for access to government funds to provide the kind of relief and development programming that major NGOs do. So I think that it's more than just an informal agreement that we would respect these rules and we would not proselytize. It really has to do with our ability to effectively access resources in order to help the people that we are there to help.
And engage in a huge network of partnerships,
yeah.
Right, Joan?
That, exactly correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, I wonder, and we're now headed into about our last 5-6 minutes, but there's something I would like you to reflect on, and it's something that's also been commented on in a lot of the coverage of the response to the tsunami, talking about the fact that certainly the response has been very generous, and that although people sort of ask this question, yes, it's true that this is certainly going to be among the world's top 10 recent natural disasters in terms of the number of deaths. However, also in recent years, many people, and in fact more people, have died from preventable disease, from poverty, and from war. For example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, war there has killed 3 million people. In the Sudan, over 2 million people. In Rwanda, 700,000 people. And that there are places around the world where people who are really hurting, who could use the help, are asking the question, what about us?
Hey, well, I'm glad you brought that up as your concluding point.
Yeah.
Just for your information, the head of the United Nations Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is my boss, Jan Egeland. Tomorrow, although he's sick as a dog with a flu, we'll be going down to brief the United Nations Security Council on the challenges in Africa. All right. Problem is, as we know, as Joan knows, mm-hmm. It seems like, you know, when there's a big crisis, the world looks at one thing. It's a very, I don't know what the word is, not unocular, but it's a very, very limited way of looking at the world. As I explained when we started off, since my office deals with the complex emergencies, not the development situations like CRS, we are incredibly frustrated at the lack of attention to places like DRC.
Mm-hmm.
Sudan has gotten some attention, all right?
Yeah.
But Ethiopia, Central African Republic, mm-hmm. all right? And this is the battle we fight year after year after year. It does help when there's a spotlight on some of these places like Darfur. It helps the funding. It helps, I think, also with political solutions being put into place. But I think it's immoral that we have situations with countries in Africa where we go out, we ask for a modest sum, and we get 40% of what we ask for, right,
yeah.
From the government.
Yes.
And in this case, what's been so wonderful, you know, if there's anything good about the response to the tsunami here, it's seeing a lot of people all over the world, as a previous caller was saying, from all faiths, you know, from all over the place, big donors, small donors, you know, kids selling lemonade because they want to help. And we need, we would argue, commensurate outreach and awareness of these other crises. I mean, these crises are going on now as we speak, right? People are dying as we have had this conversation.
Absolutely. We would absolutely agree with what Stephanie has said. And that's why we think it's so important for media outlets such as yours and
yeah.
you know, newspapers and others to continue to focus on these other areas of conflict, these other areas of need around the world. As I mentioned earlier, we're in 96 countries around the world, so we are there on the ground in all of these areas where there has been ongoing conflict, ongoing food insecurity needs, and ongoing issues with debt and the payment of interest on debt, and therefore the inability to provide for development needs within countries. So we want to continue to have a focus or awareness brought to these issues, and we want to call upon particularly the U.S. government with respect to foreign aid to ensure that these situations are funded adequately as well, that mm-hmm. there is money available to provide for aid to these situations as well as for the emergency situations.
Absolutely.
Well, and it certainly is the case. I mean, we would not want to give anybody the impression that, that this is not being discussed, that it's not on the agenda. We do have things like, for example, the Millennium Development Goals, when in under which a number of world governments have gotten together and at least said, we want to work towards cutting global poverty in half by 2015. Also, the Secretary General, Kofi Annan of the UN, appointed a commission to look at restructuring of the United Nations. And we talked about that not very long ago on the show. And one of the important points that this panel says is there's a real strong link between peace and lack of conflict in the world and development, and that we ought to be putting an awful lot more emphasis into development a lot of places around the world. So certainly people are talking about it. I guess, though, the difficulty is moving from talking about it to actually doing it and putting significant resources into doing it.
And I hate to use the word, but you need a holistic package. You need to tackle the crises. You need to tackle the countries that are coming out of crises, especially countries where there's peacekeeping missions. You know, as we've seen in Syria alone, we've seen a turnaround there. We need assistance at the development level.
Yes.
And of course, we're not going to forget the natural disasters anyway, because when they arise, they're tragic, and they make it onto into the news cycle.
It's an important question that you raise, and I would hope that your listeners are listening well to their responsibility to remain aware of these situations and to take whatever actions they deem appropriate to ensure that the focus doesn't fall away from them as well.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of our time. We want to thank our guests. Stephanie Bunker, she is Public Information Officer, spokesperson for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in New York City. And Ms. Bunker, thank you very much.
Thank you.